Okay, welcome to the Mystic Sisters podcast. I'm Julie.
I'm Amy.
And today we have a guest. His name is Josh Horner. Josh is a speaker, certified personal trainer, and peer support specialist. Josh has been a peer support specialist since 2019. A peer support specialist, say that five times fast, uses their personal life experience to help individuals who are suffering from mental health issues or disabilities. Josh has also been a speaker for the past 8 years, primarily at mental health conferences, high schools, and churches. He's spoken at numerous mental health conferences and 24 schools of about 7,000 students, and again, multiple churches. So welcome, Josh.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Should we also say that we go to church with Josh, and that's how we know Josh?
Christ the Savior.
Yes, Christ the Savior. Josh is also an Orthodox Christian.
100%. I'm a cradle dox, so I was born there.
He's a cradle dox.
You're like
in my life.
You're like a mix of cradle dox and convert because you want to
100%. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well. Yeah. I left the church. Well, I wouldn't say I left the church. I guess I left the physical church. But I was angry at God from many tragedies in my life. So I couldn't. And this is where it's cool. We talk about fasting. Kind of helped me get back into church. But I left the church because I was angry at God for things that had happened in my life, loss of my parents, and fasting and seeking Him brought me back. It's an interesting thing. Maybe we could talk on that.
Yeah, let's start there. So you were telling me some really fascinating things about how you got into fasting. Like, why did you start exploring it, and what did you learn about it that made you intrigued by it?
Okay, so I got to give some context just to my background to set up like why I was seeking this. So like I had just said, I had lost my parents early. I was 18 and my father took his life. And when I was 21, my mother died from complications from a blood clot. And this put me on a path of avoidance. So avoidance and undiscipline. So whatever felt good, I navigated to in my life. And so I started to stumble, and I stumbled a lot. I fell a lot. I was getting in a lot of trouble. And it got to the point where I found myself at a crucial decision in my life, like take care of yourself, man, or stay in jail or go to all of these places and lose all of these things that I had lost. And so I was really into personal development, and I still am, but this is where fasting kind of came in. So I was seeking level ups, and it's something that I talk about in my speeches to like build yourself, whether that's cognitively, whether that's physically, whether emotionally, spiritually. I was solely seeking physical and cognitive, and maybe a little bit of emotional, but as I went into that way through like the physical, it started to adapt and I started to see. But I got on this concept of fasting for the fact that it could help you navigate through some of these mental problems that resulted from significant trauma. And so I have significant trauma in my life, and your brain shifts with these things. Like, you look at things different. Maybe there was a lot of things that subconsciously I didn't even know I was doing because I had been stunted in a lot of ways at that time when this traumatic event hit me. So I was like, well, I've been seeing people like level up through this, so I'm going to try it. And it led me into intermittent fasting because I wanted to lose weight, but I also wanted to, you know, increase my cognitive functioning. And what I found was intense, because as I went on this path, I would push myself a little bit further each time. The first time was like 18 hours. So I was like, okay, that's not bad. And 24 goes, and that's when autophagy starts to happen. And are you guys familiar with what that is?
No, I have no idea.
So that's when your body starts to eat like the dead cells, okay? Or the cells that are not functioning correctly. And those cells are the ones that like cause cancer and like these things to come into your body that are negative, okay? So it starts to clean that up. And I didn't know any of this stuff. Like, I didn't know any of this as I was kind of like navigating into it. It was kind of look at me, I'm fasting, which the fathers tell us not to do. But I wasn't looking up. I wasn't looking at God when I started here. So I kept pushing, and at 36 hours, autophagy increases 300%. And that is insane. So your body is literally just eating itself, killing off all the dead stuff. And as you continue, you start to feel like, I don't know, you're not hungry, because after 24 hours, your body stops producing ghrelin. And ghrelin is the hunger hormone that makes you hungry. It's so interesting to me, because it's like, you would think if you're starving yourself, you would be hungry all the time. But our bodies are so capable of adaption that you actually aren't hungry. And so you kind of turn into the super soldier. And at 48 hours, this we talked about, and I can keep talking and talking and talking, but at 48 hours, BDNF starts to be produced in your brain. And that's, I wrote it down, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And what that is like a brain fertilizer, which heals old synapses, creates neurons, fixes them, and repairs them. So I started to see this in my life. Like, I had struggled with severe anxiety, depression, substance abuse and use, and I just didn't want to face anything. But fasting kind of hit me in my face to all of that stuff that I was, one, avoiding, two, I was coping with. Because if you're healing your mind and you're not avoiding things, and especially with food, because food is an avoidant, so to speak, too. Because when you feel satiated, like you're cool, like you're chill. But when you're fasted, I started to realize the attachments I had to food. I started to realize the attachments I had to people, to substances. It was like I was high, like I was tripping, to be honest, because all of these things were going on in my life. And it was like, I could see the issues, the alarm system. And then it was like, okay, man, like you have the opportunity then to shift into actually taking control of that. And I was hooked ever since then. I kind of fell off, but I'm back, baby, back into it. So
that's interesting. Yeah. So you sort of like found fasting when you were away from the church, and then you come back to the Orthodox Church, and we have a very big emphasis on fasting. Like, it's Lent right now.
Yeah.
Still Lent. Yeah. Lord have mercy.
It's still Lent, guys.
Still Lent.
I know.
Oh, okay. Still Lent. And, you know, I have to admit, I've said this before on other podcasts, that when I first became Orthodox, like, that was this thing I struggled with the most for years. I was like, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
I don't understand this. I still struggle with it. I've been able to do it more than I was able to as a new convert. But like, what is the spiritual dimension of that? I know that Father Bob has told me recently, that's our priest, that, you know, people think, especially in the Catholic tradition, they think like, oh, you're giving something up for God. And he's like, no, it's not for God. It's for us. We fast for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't have to give anything to God. God has everything.
Right? Yeah.
So I don't know, like, everything. What's your take on that? Like, when you came back into the church and there was that emphasis on fasting.
Yeah, for sure. That's good. So it's so nuts. Well, being raised Orthodox Christian, like, we fasted every Friday. We did not eat meat every Friday. And I, as a young kid, in some of the, I mean, even I've been growing out of this, like, I have a rebellious nature. If anyone kind of tells me that I have to do this, and like, I wasn't getting good explanations either. So I kind of was just like, you're just telling me not to eat meat. Like, I don't get it. I don't care. I'm going to eat it anyway. And as I fell away, I didn't have any fasting restrictions or anything. And as we come back into the church, right? So come back into the church, which was a beautiful thing. God was working so much in my life, and he still is. But yes, there's a high emphasis on fasting. And I realized that these guys, like Orthodoxy, the saints, the fathers, they were so in tune with Christ because of fasting, because it takes you away from all the things from the world, all the distraction. And when you fast, you realize how much you are dependent on him. And it brings you closer to him. It is so cool. It is like a formula, but it's hard. It's not easy. Anything easy is kind of like, but this takes discipline. This takes strength. this text faith. And in that, you start to like develop this understanding, at least in my perspective. And I can only speak on my what I've experienced. I'm not an expert on any means, but when you really dive into that and you have faith in that and you commit to it, you start to see some patterns in the world, maybe where God has been working in your life, maybe where God has been working in lives of others around you. And that excites me. That really gets me excited. So.
You're very passionate about it. It's actually very
I am.
Contagious. Yeah, it's good.
It helped me, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You had like real results in your life from this practice, and you explaining where the science meets the spiritual, which is my favorite point of anything.
Right.
So I think that's a great explanation.
And it's cool because all of these things, these monks, these spiritual fathers, they didn't know the science behind it. Mm-hmm. They didn't know like, oh, BDNF's created and it's going to help you if you've ever had trauma in your life. You know, they're doing this out of reverence to Christ. And it's like, whoa, okay, of course it's going to be a popular thing in all the other different sections of the world, right? Like in psychology, well, fast. Well, and it comes into two, it's like fasting from food. But what else do you need to fast from? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's, I think that's a huge thing, especially today with technology, with the internet, with anything like that. And I believe our culture is really fasting from Jesus right now.
No.
And that's the wrong way to go about
that's
it.
That's so real.
That's the wrong
way. Fasting from,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, we're fasting from church going. Like, people don't, like,
yeah,
yeah, they don't have a... They don't have a community that they're really embedded in where everybody's kind of focused on edifying their soul and, coming closer to God.
Or holding people accountable. Mm-hmm.
It's like, all about our pleasure. And I was thinking today about how much modern American life is about the material and acquiring more of the material. And bought a house and now I need a nice car. Oh, and now my house needs all these upgrades. And like, it just, you can get so trapped in the material mindset, especially in America. And we do have a very high standard of living, which is nice. I'm glad we're not living in squalor, but it can be a very material focus in this culture. And but we go to church in order to like clean and tend to our inner souls. That's the work that you're doing mm-hmm. there. And that's really the only
thing. It's a hospital.
It's a hospital. It's a hospital for sinners, not a museum for saints, as they say. And I think a lot of
people. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Not my quote. Don't know who said that.
okay.
But it's when we die, we're not taking any of the material with us. We don't even take our bodies. Not that they're not important, but we only take our soul. So you don't take your house or your car or any of those things you just named. So really, like, the work on your soul is the most crucial work. And that's the work that we're neglecting societally. So. Yeah, it's so
100%.
Yeah, it's so easy.
And the devil
is on the material.
And the devil is very cunning too, because he understands that we like things, you know, we like status and we like hierarchies and we like those things are like we're drawn to them, you know, like it happens. And if you throw in an addictive technology or something that is constantly grabbing your attention. And constantly giving you like that hit of dopamine. Oh my gosh, instant gratification is the destruction of so much in our world right now.
Yeah.
And it's all at your fingertips. It's all right there for you to access whatever you want. And it's really interesting because, okay, so I was also talking to you, Julie, about this book I'm reading. It's called iGen, and it's by Dr. Jean Twenge, and she is like, I believe she's a researcher on generations. So like boomers, et cetera,
cool.
Like whatever.
Yeah.
And so she does, she it's so interesting. My one client passed it along to me. She thought it would be good for me in my speeches, and it has been actually, and I used some of this stuff yesterday. But one of the things she said is that this I generation, and that's like the kids that were born into the internet. Like they never did not have a phone or knew about the internet or couldn't access it. They are the most anxious. They are the most depressed. They are the most, they have the highest rates of suicide, and they are the least religious out of all of the, all of the generations in the past. And it's like, whoa. And she directly correlates this with technology, with the iPhone. And because in the iPhone specifically, I guess, what was the last study? I think like 2 out of 3 people have an iPhone. And it is something that it's cool. I love as a sociologist, you see these trends and you like map it. Kids, there's hierarchy, of course, in kids. But now it's down to the level that's it's not tangible. It's not material. It's in that internet zone. And like, okay, so you see X, Y, and Z's person's life outside of their house, flaunting whatever you don't have. You have to take that home. That adds all of these thoughts as a young person as inferior or whatever, not cool. It's a whole status thing. And you see it. You see it playing out with the death of so many kids by suicide. It's not just something like, I mean, living here in Johnstown, there's been how many kids around here? Like it's a school every year. There was just a kid at Forest Hills like 3 months ago. Like it's something that's not just, oh, this is on the fringe. It's an actual problem that's happening. And again, I will go back to it. I think it's because we're fasting from Jesus, like 100%. Like, you know?
Yep. And so, yeah, I've heard that research a lot. And I mean, honestly, like, it's very odd, I think, probably because we're the last generation that remembers the time before the internet, before smartphones.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like something weird now where like young people are like not just interfacing with their peers in real life, but they're like also interfacing with their avatars online, right? Like it's this like third, yet like unholy like depiction of a person, right? I don't know.
It's a false persona.
Yep. False persona. You can be who you're not.
It's a false persona.
Yeah, a false persona, and you can cover things about yourself that you don't want to look at, and you don't have to account for them in the virtual world because you can be who you say you are instead of who you actually are digitally instead of in real life, where there's a lot more of a burden and a, you know, a community and people who might like hold you to task for some things. So
100%.
And like 100%. In a real community, like in a real life community, you can't like 100% curate everything and everyone around you. Like you are edified by bumping up against the harsh edges of other people or having to deal with people that might rub you the wrong way or whatever it is. And that helps you to grow in patience and love and generosity and these things, even when it's hard. But if you're just interfacing with people online, it's like, it's avoidance. Yeah. It's all curated. I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's such a good point because yes, it is avoidance and it might not look like avoidance because it's social media but it is avoidance because like you guys just said it, you're avoiding those things that sharpen you, that build your social character in the real world. And if you take that away and you can just swipe left on someone, block someone, not have to deal with it, well, that's avoidance. And guess what avoidance does? It increases anxiety. Mm-hmm. Oh, and so the more you avoid, the more you're increasing your anxiety, even unbeknownst to you. So now you have an anxiety problem, but you think this is a social, so I need to go into it. This hits me with dopamine, it's like a drug. It really is a drug.
Yeah.
And these kids are so in their phone, they're not in the world. Yesterday was an interesting speech. So I talked to 1,100 kids, and it's like keeping 1,100 kids of the I generation focused on me for an hour is quite a challenge. And I've noticed that since I started in 2016, it's got progressively harder.
Really?
And it's weird because this, and like I saw some kids in the way back on their phones, and it's one of these things. When I was in school, I don't know how it was with y'all at Central Cambria, but we weren't really allowed to have cell phones in school. I mean, we had them, but like you weren't like you weren't on them.
I'm walking in this high school. Everybody in the hallway is like this.
Whoa. Like, really?
I was like blown away. And it was so cool. Like it was, I'll just remember this. I was driving to that school. There was a little kid outside. He had to be like, I don't know, like 7. And his dad was with him. And they were at a bus stop. And the little kid was just like this. And like his dad's right there. And it was just one of those pictures like, dude, like it's, life is right in front of you.
Yeah.
But you're like you're, parents are allowing this though. And like, that's another point that Dr. Gene talks about. So parents don't necessarily, some parents, we don't leave high school in some ways. Like they want their kid to be popular or cool or fit in, like everyone does. So they're just going to feed what's in, and they're feeding them their death almost.
Ooh,
like it's so like, oh man, it's a big thing. And I don't know if many people, I mean, I hope people are turning on to it or at least trying to shift out of it. But man, if you've been living this life for 13 years with a kid who's about to be 14 and this is all you've been doing, it's going to be pretty hard to say, hey man, we got to regulate this now. And it's like, wait, I've had this 24/7 for the last 14 years. What do you mean? It's interesting.
There was an article in the New York Times like a couple of years ago about all these tech executives in Silicon Valley who don't let their kids use social media and don't let their kids use these technologies that they go to work every day to develop. I remember that setting off a lot of conversation where it was like, these people were the engineers that were going into the office to figure out how to make this stuff addictive. And then they know so much that they're like not letting their kids use it.
Yeah. That was depicted in this documentary called The Social Dilemma. And they interview like the guy who invented the phone button, you know, and said they don't let their kids use Lord any of social mercy. Media. So what does that tell you about it? It's like convenient for them because they really just designed it, poisoned everybody, and then, you know, retired with their money.
I was just like, make money and peaced out. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
We saw that documentary last semester. It was in a communications class. We watched it, and it pissed me off, to be honest, because like they had psychologists study addictive things, and that's they put these addictive factors into social media, and it's like, dude. What is that? Like,
It's designed in the way that like slot machines in Vegas are designed. It's very colorful. Mm. I've heard that one way to make yourself less addicted to your phone is to desaturate all the colors. So turn it into black and white.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, because the part of the appeal is how stimulating like the colors are in the graphics. So if you dull them down, you'll be less privy to it. But it really is like carrying a drug around in your pocket. Like, democratized, like it's mass available, and we have to fight it all the time. Like, I'm on my phone too much. I was struggling with it yesterday. I was on my phone way too much, and then I started to get headaches from the blue light.
Yeah,
and it's a serious problem. And Jonathan Haidt, is that how you say his name?
Haidt.
I'm not sure. Jonathan Haidt. He's kind of in the IDW, like associated with Jordan Peterson, and he's done a lot of research on this. I think that he has major limits on, or does he not let his children use this technology at all? It's one or the other. He either severely limits it or doesn't let them use it at all. And he always encourages parents to get together and agree with each other that they're not going to let their kids have.
That's good.
Because he says, like you were saying, well, I don't know if you quite said this, but parents are like, well, I don't want to be the only parent that's not letting my kid have a phone and all their friends have one. Like you said, they don't want to be the uncool one. So he says parents need to come together first with each other and agree not to
100.
Do this. But he's really fighting a hard battle.
Well, yeah. And so many things in our society have broken down because we don't have like a collective consensus about what standards we should enforce.
Yeah.
Right? We've really devolved into this like live and let live culture of like, well, as long as you're not hurting anyone, it's like, but you are. Like maybe you are hurting somebody, you know? And it's like, we don't really think collectively anymore on a lot of issues, right?
Yeah.
And like, you know.
Well, again.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I always will turn it back to like spiritual stuff. Like the devil's the divider. Yeah. Like all of this stuff is being pushed, and it separates us so much. And the lack of community, like I think that's such a great idea, having parents get together and be like, hold the standard, hold the line. And especially like
the culture that we have is so affirming on everything that you want to do that feels good that might not be good for you.
Yep.
And it's like, that's it.
Let's expand on that a little bit. Like, because we were talking about that the other day. Like, what do you see? What do you see as the problem with how therapists and mental health practitioners approach people who have anxiety or have depression? Like, what is the modern ethos around mental illness and why is it so twisted?
So working in mental health has taught me so much. I mean, I've learned so much, and having like mental health issues that I've had to work out through myself and going to counseling, I've learned many things. Like, I've seen many things. I take a lot of notes, and it's like, one of the main things that I see is this affirming thing where instead of like giving you maybe the piece of bread that might be bitter, it's all this sugar, and to make you feel okay and comfortable, and it's okay. And of course, this, it's almost like a victim mentality. And yo, you will fall that way. It might feel nice to hear these things, but sometimes, most of the time, we need a structure. We need to establish, because okay, my life, for example, a lot of crazy things happen. You know, my father took his life. My mother died shortly after. I had a strew of people dying, homeless, all this stuff. People danced around that. Okay. And like a lot of things. Yeah. But the best things that I learned, the best people who talked to me were the ones who gave me tough love, who gave me like, yo, man, you got to like pick up your cross. Like, you got to stop saying like you're this way because of this. And I've been seeing, since I started working like this 5, 6, 7, 8 years now, that has the bar has been lowered. Like, the bar has been lowered because it's almost like a sense of you're almost in an in-group if you have a mental disorder.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, isn't that nuts? Like, can you guys remember back to high school? Like, We didn't talk about that stuff.
This was not.
Like, I was in high school. Like,
it was not cool.
2004.
To be
Like, you, and now people wear their depression right here, and it's like, yo, if you want to wear it there, like where you struggled through, and now you're living life and you made it, awesome.
Right.
But if you're still living in that, like, oh, because of this and this, it's like, hey, at what point do we take the responsibility for our lives? And I don't know if that's being told enough. I think it really is, oh, you feel this way? Well, how do we make you feel better? Feel better. Yo, emotions come and go. And they're not always right, especially if we're not fasted. Like, and I mean from not just like, hey, go fast from food. I mean from all of the stuff. If we're so, we get whatever we want, how do we know? How do we know it's right then? How do we know which way's up? It's frustrating.
I think
it's frustrating, so to speak.
And what you're pointing to is like a self-indulgence. Like, instead of dealing with this hard thing, I'm gonna like indulge that I'm special and like it's all okay.
Yeah.
And then I don't have to deal with it. And then I also get social points for being brave enough to admit that I have this. It's all very twisted, and it's not actual healing. I think that what started to happen when we were younger is that there was this movement to destigmatize. It was like, we remove stigma
to
the people
get
help.
Sure.
But now that like has gone so far that it's now like endorsed. So it's like, the thing is that like stigmas are in place around bad things. Things you don't want to be, right? So when you remove stigma, then it's like there's nowhere else for the culture to go than into this realm of like total acceptance. And then total acceptance gets into coddling and enabling, right? And it just like it moved, the goalposts have like moved way too far in that direction. And I don't know if you've read up on the different types of cultures that there have been around the world, but you mentioned about how like people now become esteemed if they have mental illness, right? Or if they're a victim, right? Because often the idea also is that you have mental illness because of society. Society's not being good to you. Society's this and that. So that's why you're mentally ill. So we esteem the victim.
But in other cultures, they were honor cultures, right? Where everything was about defending your honor, protecting your honor, or dignity cultures, which were very similar. It was all about like shoring up your dignity. Like for in an honor culture, you would like duel somebody to the death, right? In a dignity culture, you would like turn the other cheek and retain your dignity and not like fight that person, right? But in a victim culture, you are raised up if you can claim a victimhood status.
Ooh.
Yeah. So that all feeds into how we deal with mental illness today.
Yeah. And there's a level of that. So victim, it's so, okay. So if you're like a female with mental illness, or say you identify as non-binary. So now you're even more different.
Yep.
And now you have this. Okay. So that becomes like, Amy, I think you said it's social points. I like that. I think that's a true thing. Like, yeah, that's interesting to me. And then you throw the internet. So say you're in a high school where, you know, they're not about that. So you can go to the internet, to the internet. You can find your demographic on the internet. You can live in that. And then you can become completely isolated in the town that you're at. Well, what does that do? Isolation, more anxiety, depression. It's such a hard, and what do you do? Like, because now, like we talked about earlier, there's no general consensus on this stuff. So many people are like, well, we got to be sensitive to, you know, what the kids feel. And then half people are like, no, this is ludicrous. What are we doing? We're hurting kids. Look at the rates that. It's hard. Really hard. And I think, though, there needs to be some real conversations, some really hard conversations where people look at each other in the eyes. Ugh, I don't know if that can happen, but.
Yeah, I really like that you pointed out that people are opting into internet subcultures and spending all their time there in a virtual subculture, and that it's isolating from the people around them. So people are like alone in crowded rooms, right? And it doesn't matter where you live, 100%. That this can happen. Like you can be a small town or a city and be atomized is what. And it's like, instead of learning how to connect with the people around you and how to like do those acts of kindness or find those vulnerabilities that help you to connect with people, you just retreat into a digital world. And it's not real socializing. That isn't real socializing. It's fake. Because like we said, you're putting on a persona and not being totally honest.
And I want to highlight too, like people who do this, like I'm not saying, like I'm not judging you for your retreat to that, you know, like I want to encourage you to navigate into a space where, you know, you have some bravery. Be brave, be strong. Mm-hmm. Those are good things. And you know, again, from fasting from Jesus, but like if we were, say, our culture. We were reading the Bible. Like we were reading the Bible. Okay. That's Joshua 1:9. Be strong and of good courage. Do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you may go. Yo, if you remembered that when you're fighting anxiety or you're fighting all of this social pressure where you feel isolated and alone, but you knew God was with you, how far could you go? And it's like, again, we're fasting too much from that. And like Jean says, this generation is the furthest away from religion and God. Lord have mercy.
Right, because if you're only being affirmed in your distortions, you don't have to be brave. Because in order to work through them, you have to be brave, right? Ooh. So people who are supposedly helping people who have these issues, they're not being brave either. Because in order to give someone tough love, you have to be brave. You have to risk them being angry at you. You have to risk their negative reaction. But it's a mark of love, because that is what's going to help them get better, rather than this like coddling enablement that just hurts. And speaking of like people wanting the easy ways out or to couch themselves from pain, like I would say Orthodoxy is one of the most, if not the most hardcore Christian, I guess you want to say denomination. I believe it's the true faith, but it's very hardcore. Nothing about it is like easy. It asks a lot of us. I think that might be why it's one of the smaller sects of Christianity in the United States. It's like, it's pretty hardcore. Like we have three major fasts a year or more. Third of the year spent fasting. We pray, our services are long. You know, it's pretty, but the thing with that is, you know, and we stand up a lot in some churches more than others.
Yeah.
Like all of, I remember when I first started coming to church and I'd sing in the choir, I would have like these little fits where I'd kind of be like, oh, I'm still like woozy. I was very weak and I'd like sit down. And then over time, now I can get through the whole liturgy singing. So all this to point to the fact that like, you know, avoiding, like you go towards the hard thing and then it eventually the hard thing is conquered and then you can do the next hard thing. And that's how life is supposed to work. It's exposure therapy. This used to just be like, and we went away from exposure therapy and towards like coddling.
Retreat, avoid, retreat. Right.
And the internet communities are easier, right? You're not fully seen in the internet community. Like
you're
not
in your body.
You're not in your body. You're not embodied. You're a shade of who you are in the digital realm. And so how where are the opportunities there, right? To become more.
And you're not who you are. Yeah. You could be whoever you want to be. Right? You can pretend, you know, like
and get that affirmation.
Those things too. It's like What are you going to do in your real life?
Yeah.
Like, are you, how does that transition? I wonder, like, how does that transition? Like, how can you not have mental health issues if that's what you're doing?
Yeah.
If you're playing two different people, three different people, I don't know how much it goes. Mm-hmm. It's, And again, exposure, like that was a good point, Amy. Like this is, it just used to be commonplace and now we have a name for it. Oh, Lord have mercy. That's the truth. And Again, I used to be a very good avoidant, and I still am on some levels. I'm still working through some of these things, but I have certainly found you do the thing you fear the most, and the death of fear is certain in some regard, in some percent. You've become stronger. You've bolstered yourself. You realized it wasn't as scary as you thought it was. And I think that's a lot of this too, is all this fear, all this fear. There's so much fear in the world right now. It's so weird. And that this is another point this doctor makes. They are the most secure generation, the most fearful.
Wow, it's like, what a paradox, right?
That's,
and like conquering that fear, the whole symbology, is that a word? Symbology? What are you trying to say?
I get it.
Of resurrection is going into the darkness, going into the underworld, so to speak, going into that fear and
100.
Death. And overcoming it, right?
The resurrection. Right.
Yep. Yeah. It's like that's what the whole thing is. And we're doing that like every minute of every day, really. If you really think about it on a micro level, like every minute of the day, I'm making a choice not to like curl up in a ball and do nothing, right? Or whatever it is. Like you're always having to do that death and resurrection process of conquering and coming back up, you know? And I think you mentioned the Bible. People should be reading the Bible to get some sort of strength and something, a foundation for themselves. Yeah. I think in the Bible, how many times does it say, do not be afraid? And it never says, be afraid. Yeah. Ever.
365.
Yes. Wait.
365.
Really?
Every day of the year, baby. Let's go.
That's cool.
100. You can't tell me God's not real. Let's go. For real, right? Like, it's so beautiful.
It's all real.
And I would highly recommend, too, Proverbs is a really good way to navigate, because it shows you what to do in situations. It's quite beautiful, and it gives you like if you're seeking, again, like I don't know the Bible, I haven't read all of it, I've read a lot of it, but Proverbs is good because it gives you scenarios that happen in the world that you're going to face and ways to navigate through them. And I think that's very vital. And we're not looking there though. Like people aren't looking there as much as maybe they should. And I don't want to shoot on anybody, but maybe we need to. Like we need to be in there and doing these things. And
Your intentions with good. Your should intentions are good.
Yeah, my intentions were good.
Well, and we live in the time of loosened and eroded boundaries, and like we just need a little more of that discipline, that no, that hard line. Like we need that back. Missing the daddy energy.
I can speak from experience on that. Losing my father at 18 was such, like looking at it now, that was 18 years ago. And the amount of I need a dad in my life, it is cool. I need a father to tell me no. I need a, because when my dad died, like I had my mother for like 2.5 years, and listen, I don't know about y'all, but I could get away with more with my mom than my dad, like 100%, like 100%. And so if you don't have the father there to hold the line, it can let someone who goes on their emotion or what feels good, you can get out of control. And that's exactly what happened to me. No one told me no. No one told me not to do this. Everyone tried to coddle me a little bit. There were some people that told me no, but it wasn't as, if you're just someone and tells me no, like, okay, you're not my father. And it's real interesting because when I came back to the faith, I came back for God the Father. Like, I was looking at God the Father, not so much Jesus. I've been looking at Jesus more, but I was looking at God the Father, and I realized, and I say this in my speeches now, like, I realized everything that feels good isn't good for me. And he showed me how consistent and how loving he is. And it's cool because I don't have an earthly father, but I have a heavenly father that loves me and does want me to do good and wants me to be strong and wants me to say no and hold the line too, which I'm learning. And it's been a difficult process, so to speak, without a father. You know, it's important. But again, like, I think our culture too, Lord have mercy, there's no sacredness on marriage anymore either. And I say that because it's so easy for people to peace out, leave kids, not be the father they're supposed to be. And that's a crisis too.
Yep.
That's a big crisis too.
It's all related.
It's all related. It really is. It's all related. It's like this giant war, and there's many different fronts. And we can't fight every front, but if what we're good at, hopefully we can fight that front or give to that front, you know? And I've learned that too in this journey, because I try to do everything all the time. And that, I think that's a tactic from the devil. Uh-oh. We got to do what we, the gifts that we're good.
Right.
And you know, I forget what saint it said. He said that the devil attacks us in 8 different ways. Top, bottom, left, right, front, back, inside. And one of the ways is, all the good things that you want to do, trying to do all of them at once. And then you fail, and then you think you're a piece of crap and you get into your head. And
Interesting.
It's a whole thing.
I think the summation here is, like, you know, archetypally speaking, like, fathers hold boundaries and, like, draw lines. And speaking really generally, and like the mother's role is more like the nurturing and the that kind of thing,
comfort,
emotional comfort, and things like that. And we have this excess of, like, female energy and emotional comfort right now.
Yeah.
And not enough of people like, no, it's that is a so bad much. Thing. You're not doing it. Like, that's what we need more of. Yeah. And I mean, I think we saw that a lot during COVID, where it was just this, like, fear-based, like, coddling, like, safety culture instead of, like, we're going to show up. We're going to, like, trust. We're going to not have fear. And we're going to, like,
be brave.
Right. Be brave. And it was just like, let's serve our fear instead of serving our faith. And everything we did was in service to our fear. And I think that you probably are seeing that with youth culture now, too. Like, if they're afraid to go out and socialize, they serve their fear by just retreating into their phone or whatever it is.
Yeah, retreat, video games, whatever it is.
Even with men today, like, not even feeling like they can give discipline or dole out discipline or hold a boundary or whatever. They're afraid. They're living in their fear of being reprimanded or having social consequences or whatever it may be. So the whole society is just a wreck.
That's huge.
Like on every dimension. And it's because of all these things. Like, we don't have that father energy right now.
It's so true. And you know, it's interesting. I train a lot of women. Okay. Yeah. I train a lot of women. So I talk to a lot of women. I hear a lot of these things. And it's interesting because the women that I train are good people, but they certainly have this almost critical viewpoint on, and if y'all are watching this, I love you so much. Okay. But they have this critical, like, mindset towards men and masculinity that I think is very unhealthy. I think the right type of masculinity is right. There's toxic of everything, you know? But if we try to erase masculinity, Lord have mercy,
we're going to destroy ourselves. Mm-hmm. There is a complementary half here. Like, that's supposed to happen. That's divine energy there. Once you kind of go against that, well, yeah, duh, it's all going to be messed up. Right. We're going to have a higher divorce rate. We're going to have people thinking they're girls and people thinking they're boys. And it's just a whole mess.
Yep.
St. Anthony called it, man. He called it so hard. There's going to be a time when people who are sane are called insane, mm-hmm. and those who are insane called sane, and they will persecute you because they think you're insane, but you're sane. And
yep.
I mean, we're seeing it.
Yes.
We're seeing a lot of that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Seeing a lot of that right now. It's frustrating though, but I think though, again, I would encourage people to continue, or at least look to Christ, look at the light, look at the good things, because what we look at, we kind of step up into, and it's okay to look at the things that are problems. That's why we have anxiety initially as an alarm system. It's to tell us, oh, there's a problem. There's a thing. Our amygdala is going, there's a lion over here. But if your amygdala is constantly, constantly, constantly working, well, then you're not making the right decisions at all. Okay. Like you're going to be acting out of fear again.
Right. Yep.
Lord.
So like, what do you think are overall solutions to this? We touched on a lot of things, but I mean.
Yeah. Well, so I.
Yeah.
Like, okay, continue. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you
off.
Well,
I might be taking it into another topic, but you were talking about people saying they believe in Christ, but not seeking to know him.
Mm.
And so I don't know if that's related to how what you see as solutions to all of this, but.
Well, I certainly think the number one solution is pursuing Christ with your entire being, like 100%. That is the solution. Now, there's practical stuff that I think can help us get there, even if people aren't necessarily looking at Christ. I think taking care of yourself is very important. Very, very important. Physically, emotionally, mentally, and pursuing that. Like pursuing that. And again, I can only speak on my own, but I was doing that and I found him. Like I found Jesus through that. In my pursuit, it's so crazy how that happened. But he knows you. God knows our language. He knows how to talk to us. He talks to us in the way that we understand. And if you're listening and if you're seeking, he'll talk to you and he'll show you which way to go. So I think developing an understanding of that is very good. But if you're not there yet, well, okay, take care of yourself physically. Because, okay, we are so, our culture is so about eating and nutrition is not good. And our physical bodies aren't that good. We're the most obese country. Like it's a real thing.
Yeah.
And that now they're finding that has direct correlation with cognitive ability.
Yeah.
So if you're not taking care of this and you're like, ah, whatever, I still got this. Well, hey, brother, I have something to tell you. You're not operating at the level that you could be because you're not taking care. And it comes down to doing work. It comes down to doing work. You have to do work. You have to be disciplined. You know, I think that is so important. And when you are physically fit, I'm not saying you got to go be a bodybuilder or you got to be the skinniest model out there. I'm just saying when you're capable, when you're living up to where your body can be, you see better, you hear better, you're calmer in yourself. It fights anxiety exponentially and depression. So I think that's a really big thing. I think taking care of ourselves is very, very important.
Well, and back to saying, no to things and having boundaries is like our society is saturated with unhealthy food. When you go to the grocery store, you have to mostly say no to what's on the shelf.
Yeah.
Most of it, you have to say no to. Most of it is processed junk. So like just that alone, just grocery shopping is like an exercise in discipline and like discernment, mm-hmm. right? I think that a lot of
people, how many people don't know though?
No, they don't know. This is what I've realized. I think people think, well, they wouldn't sell it if it was really bad for me. And if someone's regulating that, it's like, no. Well, this is reasonable here in America. Yeah. In Europe maybe. Yeah. And that's why we're so obese. It's like we don't value saying no. We don't value discernment. And we don't value, once again, back to that sort of like collective agreement on things. of like, you know what? Maybe you shouldn't be allowed to sell a product that has more than half double the recommended daily sugar allowance, right? Like, why are we even selling products like that, right?
Or diabetes. Diabetes is such, type 2 diabetes runs rampant in our culture.
Yeah.
And Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
They're finding that all of these things are correlated with food.
Yep.
It's like, dude. And but again, though, I do think people are starting to wake up to this stuff.
Yeah.
Like I think, because there's a lot of information. There's people, like, there's good people out there giving a lot of good content. Like Andrew Huberman, I don't know if you guys are familiar with him. But he is a professor at Stanford, and he gives like high level thinking, dumbs it down and gives it to the masses to educate them so they can make better decisions. I think it's beautiful. I think that's happening, but it's very like, when I was younger, you would hear things like, oh yeah, they're trying to get you dumb, dependent, stupid, and fat. And it's like, wait, that's actually true.
Yeah.
That's actually true.
Yeah.
Because,
that kind of pisses me off. Honestly, like people who are in that state, who are not good at saying no, who are not personally disciplined, they're not self-governed, they're easier to control. If you don't control yourself, nobody else can control you.
Yeah.
Right? And whether that's or the government or whatever it is, if you're not self-controlled, you're easier to control.
Well, you need to be self-controlled, but also we've created this culture where we put so much of the control onus on the individual, and people do need like leadership.
Yeah.
And like elites, I suppose, to set
that they can trust
role models, but everything is on you to fight. And it's tough. I feel for people and how, atomized they are and how much burden is on the individual to fight everything. And it's sort of this, like, we need this, like, equal balance of
between the culture and the individual.
The culture and the individual. Yeah, the tension. We need the individual to be shored up and strong, but we also need the culture to aid the individual and not hold their back.
Right, and it's not.
Right now, our culture drives you down into hell. Like, a culture is supposed to
elevate
everyone and help usher people to heaven, like to, theosis,
like when cultures do this, like in history, when cultures start to do this, like they fall or major things happen. Their wars happen, revolts happen, rebellions happen. This is not something that's just like, this isn't a big deal. Like, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, people are dying. People are deceived. Like, you're being controlled by factors that you're not even really aware of. And that's, Lord have mercy. I wish I could do more. You know, I want to, that's why I go to speak to kids. Like, I love to talk to kids. I want to shake them and wake them up. Put your phone down, get into the world, get active, make decisions for yourself. You know, I think that's an important thing to do. I'm all about prevention, but I wanted to talk about what you said about people know Jesus or people believe in Jesus, but they don't know him. I think that's a good thing because people can say they believe in him, but without knowing him, like, and he even says, like, you know, I forget the Bible verse. But where they come in, where they're at the gates, and he's like, "Get away! I didn't even know you."
Yep.
And like, you can say, like, you believe in Jesus. Like, well, I believe that so and so is alive, or I believe in this food is going to help me, whatever. But if you don't know, and knowing takes action, like knowing takes pursuit, like you must make a decision to know somebody. Like, I can say I know you guys and never met you once. Like, I don't, or say I believe in you, but I don't know you because I haven't taken any steps to get to know you, to see what you're about, what you like, all these things. That's the same thing with Jesus. It's like, I'm not hating on any Protestants in this world by any means, but because I have a lot of friends that are Protestant, but I see some things that I think, if you could go a little deeper, you might see some things that you want to see, and he'll change you in ways maybe you want to be changed. But it takes like this deep getting to know
you know?
And yeah,
I think that's an interesting point.
Yeah, we were talking about that because I know that you've spent time around like Protestant churches, and I had a brief period of my life where I was as well. And this idea that it's like a one and done, you're saved, it's done thing as soon as you believe, is odd. It always struck me as odd because it almost struck me as nihilistic, because it's like I have all this life left to live, right? And I'm going to always have to be striving and watching I don't fall off the path and getting to know who God is, right? And what he wants and how to be better. And it's not a one and done thing. And so I think the way that,
it's an interesting.
Well, yeah, and the way that my priest explained it to me is that like we were saved.
Who's your priest?
We're being saved and we will be saved.
Yeah.
It's like all of time in one thing. It's not like, when were you saved? Like I was
May 4th.
You know, it's not
I know some people who have those dates.
I know.
Yeah,
you know?
I was mocking them a little because they do that. They ask you what date you were saved. It's very strange.
Yeah.
And also for me,
it's hard for me to understand.
Right. And for me also, like my coming to Christ was this slow, gradual, grueling thing. And my knowing Christ is going to be a slow, gradual, grueling thing.
Yeah.
Like
right.
That is just going to continue until I die. And hopefully.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. So
I think that's a good point to that too. It's because it's like, well, I believe in Jesus. Okay, peace. I'm going to go do whatever I want.
Yeah.
But the knowing is a whole thing for your entire life. It's dying to yourself. John 3:30, he must increase and I must decrease. That's real.
Yeah.
That's real. And that's how you get to know him. Theosis, man, like that. Yo, that's the best adventure you'll ever go on.
Right.
And it's a long one.
Yes. And
it's a long one. It's your life.
The concept of theosis gives our lives so much meaning, I think. And it's interesting, too, because I think it can be hard from our vantage point to see how God's working on us. Sometimes it takes years for something to like come into focus or for the full picture to come into view.
Yeah.
But just knowing that you are in his church, you're participating in the sacraments, and you are on this path of edification gives your life meaning in a way that one and done saved just doesn't satisfy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to have a conversation about that because like with someone who believes that I haven't yet. And I've wanted to, because I don't get it. And now, I know a lot of Protestants who are doing a lot of good stuff in the world, who are putting a lot of Christ out there and stuff like that. But that to me, I just don't get it. I think it's like Father Bob said, like it's all three. It's past, future, and present.
Yeah.
And that's what God is. You know, that's what God is. He doesn't distinguish between times.
Right. He's outside of time.
I think it's deeper.
Mm-hmm.
It's deeper. And to say I'm saved.
Arrogant.
To say I'm saved is pretty, is like, wait a minute. How do you know that? Like that's something I wrestle with too, because I get what they're saying. Like I get what they're trying to say. But again, on that, it's like, well, how do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. Like it's,
but I say so.
It doesn't leave
self-focused.
Yeah. Kind of. Right. And you know, I have to mention this too. I've been seeing a lot. One thing I love about Orthodoxy that I think is very valid is that, I mean, there is hierarchy, but it's not like, okay, it's not like come to like our priest, Father Bob's service. It's not necessary. It's not that. It's come to the divine liturgy. But I see in like the Protestant world, they use like their name and then put ministries after it.
Mm.
And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. I thought we're supposed to do Jesus Christ's ministry here.
Mm.
And like, when we cut that to me, and like, yo, they could be solid and all that and do a lot of good. But I think when we start to elevate ourselves and like that's a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
The dangerous, dangerous, dangerous thing.
Like, well, even sola scriptura, right? This idea that like the Bible is the only authority lends itself to all these like individual interpretations of the Bible, right? It's like, it's one of the easiest critiques of Protestantism, but it's true. It's like, if it's just about us, and there's no broader church or tradition or church fathers or inheritance or whatever it is.
Apostolic trust.
And it just becomes about me and my interpretation and what I think this verse means. And then that gets obviously hairy, and then you get all these
different. It's very American, isn't it?
So yeah, America is a very Protestant country.
Yeah,
you can
see these
individualism problems because this was a Protestant country. It came from Protestantism, which is only as old as like the 1500s.
Well, like people don't know this, but our like Supreme Court is modeled after, is it the Methodist? The way that they've structured their church, they have like a council, and like if there's like an issue in the church, they have like councils, and it goes up the chain, right? And it's like our legal system is very similar. Yeah. So, you know, there's just there are the ways in which America is very individualistic, and also tends to have that focus on the material. And it's just lacking in these like deeper traditions, that we find in the Orthodox Church. I mean,
the symbolism is kind of cut out. Of things.
Things are very literal.
Yeah.
And
that's a good
even
point.
Like, you know, the idea of like, oh, just do no harm, do what you want as long as it's not hurting anyone. It's like your idea of hurt is just that, like, you didn't punch anyone in the face. Like, again, material idea of hurt.
Yeah.
But hurt can be abstract and social. So it's not a helpful metric. So,
like whenever we don't shame and condone each other for sleeping around or ghosting. I talked about ghosting on the last on an episode. Like, if we don't say, "Hey, why did you stop talking to her? And you guys had a relationship. Why are you treating her that way?" Right? Instead of, "Oh, not my business."
Yeah.
Right. You know. And
it's so easy to do that.
Yeah. So
it's so easy to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well. I think this has been great.
Yeah, it was good. Thanks for
Josh. Is there anything you want to plug? Like anything that you want to share with people where they can find you online or anything they should look into?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can find me on my Instagram. It's Joshua_Fireheart. That'd be cool. I plan to kind of start producing more content. I'm rebranding my podcast to Fireheart Productions.
Nice.
And so that will be coming. I have a couple episodes coming here. Trevor's coming next week. You guys know Trevor.
Our buddy. Yeah.
He had to cancel on Monday. But yeah, that's it. And I would love to plug the number one thing is Jesus Christ. like 100%. Like
that's awesome.
Like look to him. You know what I mean? Like look to him for all of it. He's the way, the truth, and the life, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Well, thank you, Josh.
Amen.
We'll see you at church.
You're very welcome.